for a very, very long time. And so I know her in a different way, and I'm really interested in learning about her experience right now, because I know her to be a very honest and candid person, and this is something I've been looking forward to, frankly.
Oh, well, thank you.
So I think we maybe can start with Heather posted something on Facebook, and it really spoke to me. I think she's put some postings that have been shared a lot. And it's good to hear from someone who's actually having the experience. We can all have our opinions and our ideas and judgments, but if you're not in it, I don't think you really get a grasp for what it's like. And I believe it's very important to understand the plight of people that are working in the hospital right now in these units and what that looks like and how that affects mental health, which is, of course, our connection. So, Heather, would you mind reading your post?
Sure. I had probably the most difficult shift of my career yesterday. I hope everyone understands that for my own mental health, I'm going to have to start blocking people who are posting claims about government conspiracy, obsessing over numbers, and arguing about things I can't handle. Please know, this does not mean I don't care about you. Part of me wants to educate you in order to protect you and your loved ones from this virus. Today, I realize I have to let go and let God. If you or a loved one become ill, I am still here for you. You may call me even if I have blocked you. No judgment. I just can't handle seeing and doing what I do with all of this misinformation in my feed. I can't be in two marathons. May God bless you all.
That was just awesome, I think, to read. Is exactly what a lot of us are dealing with. I think when we look at our social media feeds, we talk about this all the time, how you get inundated with information and arguments, and it's overwhelming. So I can't even imagine what it must be like when you're working in this world and you see and you know from what you're faced with on a daily basis, and then have to deal with the social media aspect of it, must be really tremendously difficult.
And I find myself wanting to, you know, respond to people that are, I think, Melanie, I said, you find yourself wanting to respond to people's stupidity. And I'm thinking they aren't really trying to be that way on purpose, but it comes across that way. So there's times that I just have to shut down social media because I can't deal with that anymore. So to actually actively work in that, and then to have to hear all of those that misinformation that gets spread so easily, I think it would be tremendously hard not to respond.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it really is. I feel kind of a responsibility for it, because a lot of these people, you know, they watch all of our culture right now, watches this continuous news feed. And you have opinions over which news station gives you the accurate thing, but all of them are doing it over and over and over, and the same stories over and over, and it's brainwashing. I mean, it just is. And I stopped watching the news about a year ago, and I read, you know, different articles, and I see different points of view, and I can't handle that stress anymore. But when you have somebody that keeps saying things and you're trying to explain, okay, those numbers, I don't care if that's not accurate, that there's a human being there, you know, and when you see those human beings, I've been trying to convey that, okay, what I'm saying is right here, right now in Midland, not in New York, not in Italy, not anywhere else, you know, this is what's going on, but I can't do that anymore. I have to focus on this battle, because that's the battle I've been kind of trying to do a little bit in between, and I can't handle that anymore, personally.
Yeah. So, Heather, can you walk us through some of the most difficult moments that you experience when you're dealing with patients that are in an extremely critical place, and how quickly it can evolve from what doesn't seem visibly so critical?
Yeah, without giving too much information, I wouldn't want any families to feel like I'm talking about their loved ones, of course, but they're scared. You know, everybody is afraid, and we show up, and we have our smiles on, and we're trying to be soothing and calm, because we're their window to the outside outside world. You know, we have to have that.
You have to be a source. Yeah, you have to be a source of comfort on top of all of the other things, which nurses are typically a source of comfort. But there's no family members there, so
right.
That adds to your responsibility and how it has got to affect your emotional state.
It does. We always connect with people. That kind of nurse comes from the word nurture. You know, I mean, it we have real connections with people, and we like to have a repeated shift. So, like, if I have a shift on the med-surg COVID unit, I want to be on that same unit the next day so that I know who my patients are. I know more than just the reports that I got. You know, I know what they were doing yesterday, and I can see it a little bit easier. But you really, really connect with these people. But I had the experience where we went from having a discussion of a D&I to hospice, and then a visitation, you know, video conference to a death within a shift, and it wears on you. And then to come home and think, I need to just look at some memes, you know, I need to look at some pictures of that, and then pull up people saying, you know, these numbers are wrong, and this lab posted this wrong, and this number is wrong, and it just gets to be too much, because I'm like, this is a human being. I now have one of those numbers on that screen that was an amazing, amazing human being. I mean, all of those numbers were amazing human beings in our community. They were somebody's loved ones. And I think that we're not seeing a lot of people that are posting about, you know, their loved ones, because, I mean, how would you like to try to defend that to people that are thinking all this is fake or made up, or that it's all to get somebody kicked out of office? I don't understand the paranoia of, or the importance of that over human, you know, over a human life.
I think a lot of times we don't really understand things until they affect us personally as a society. And it's a shame. It's unfortunate. But, I think Heather was, definitely around with me when we had to put my kid on a ventilator for a car accident. And one of the things that I'll always think about, and I've brought this up many times, is if you don't understand the severity of it, if you've not seen it, and you realize, and back then, I mean, it wasn't like he shared that space with anyone, you know, and it was terrifying. And so this is a real, it's real. And what the nurses do to keep the families comfortable even, and now that that's not a possibility, what is that like, having this isolation now that family members cannot be in the hospital, like on all levels?
Honestly, it's really hard. So, you know, you have to have these difficult discussions, and then I have to contact the family and break it to them. And of course, you don't know how they're going to take it. And there's always going to be crying, because you're basically telling someone that they're not going to come home. And that is a hard conversation. And while you're doing this, you might have a patient that is having strokes, you know, or, you know, like mini strokes, or you might have another patient that has horrible diarrhea and all the horrible, wonderful things that come with that, that, you know, nurses make a lot of jokes about that. We shouldn't joke about that. But, you know, there's a lot of issues that, we can't control, and it all builds up, and you think, am I spending time in this one? Am I doing enough time? Because this might be his last moments. Mm-hmm. Am I spending enough time in this room for emotional support? I mean, it's a big responsibility. So hospice is called in, and we look at comfort care. And normally when we do hospice, we'll do like a 2-liter nasal cannula just to give them enough oxygen to feel comfortable as they pass away. But when you can't breathe, you go into a panic. We choose to kind of keep them, you know, as comfortable as we can. And, but we try as much as possible to, you know, keep them as comfortable as we can, and give them everything they can have to not panic from this. But
it's terrifying for them, and it's terrifying for us. And to have to do a video conference, you know, with a family member, you know, to say goodbye, and just the toll that that takes. You also see the responsibility. Like, I'm responsible for this one human being in this bed, or these four human beings on this floor. And then you have the next step would be the physician that is also having to consider all the people in the community. And then you have administration that's considering anyone that is near the hospital as a physician or an employee or a family member, you know, or a worker, people working on our roof, anybody. I mean, they're responsible for that and for the transmission of this throughout the community. And it goes along with everything that's going on through the U.S. And, you know, I follow a lot of boards, and it's the same, because when you have these big peaks, all it takes is just a couple. And I think we're already to that point right now where it's kind of irreversible. We just need to slow it down a little bit, because everything that we did this weekend is going to be in 2 weeks. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, right now we're still taking the lash from Memorial Day. We're still dealing with that. And in people's defense, I mean, I don't want them to feel guilty or feel like we're shaming them, because I thought I was finished with a sprint. I was a swimmer back in the day, you know, and I know a lot of people run, and so maybe this analogy works, but it's kind of like, we see this coming, we're doing really well, we're going to really, really hope it was over in the summer, and so we sprinted and did all this extra work and sweated and said, I'm exhausted, but it's going to be okay, because I'm going to get it over with. I'm not going to go here or here, because it's okay, I'm going to get over this. I have a kid that lives out of town that I didn't get to see. Things that you're thinking, that's all right, I'm just postponing it. And then summer gets here and it gets worse. Like, mm-hmm. not just a little worse, it's way worse. And you realize that you just went all out on 100 when you have to go a mile. And when you reach that point, like when I swam, and you'd reach that point where you're like, what, I have to do it again, you know, or you run and you go around the corner and you're like, oh my gosh, I'm nowhere near. It knocks the air out of you. I mean, there's a huge mental game where you have to adapt and push, and it's extremely difficult.
Well, I think a lot of us are experiencing that feeling. It's kind of a fatigue. It's the quarantine fatigue. It's the 2020 fatigue. I don't know. It's there's a lot. We have so much going on. I would like to ask, what is your routine look like when you're transitioning from your shift? That's always interesting.
Well, it's funny. When this first started, you know, you read all these things, and of course, you know, you learn a little bit more. You know, we've got new updates every day for that first few weeks, and it was crazy. But for a while, I had set up my camper in the front yard, and I was going to be sleeping in the camper. And it was still cool enough where I could do that, because I don't have the plug or whatever it requires. My husband told me what it needs to be able to work in the driveway, but we couldn't hook the air conditioner up because we didn't have the right power source. But so we had it set up, and I was going to sleep in this stinky old camper where he had rotten eggs in the fridge. So I come home, I text him ahead of time and saying I'm coming. I go in through the back gate, walk up to where my back bedroom is. We have a hot tub, and I completely disrobe, put everything out, spread out on top of that. And then I spray it off with, I have Lysol Scentiva. It smells very nice. But I also kind of clean things as I go throughout the day and wrap up, like, cell phone and things like that. But I lay it all out. And this was my first day coming back. And then I walk into through my back door, and he already has the shower going for me, my husband. And he has it set as hot as you can get, so I have the room very, very steamy. I turn the shower down a little bit so I can step in there, but I still have that steam where I feel like it's going into my lungs, you know, it's opening up my lungs and everything, and I start washing. I personally use lava soap because it's exfoliating also, and I just want to make sure that nothing's on my skin. I know some people use antibiotic or antibacterial, but viruses are a lot smaller than bacteria from, you know, what I remember from my classes, you know, in the micro. So the chances of doing that were little. since then, I'm not as worried about that as it's been coming out with studies, but I still go through those measures just to make sure, because I know they might turn around and say no. But so I strip that down. You know, I wash my face very, very well. Of course, my hair, I use a stripping agent on my hair also. So I have a complete decon before I get out of the shower and have dinner. So usually my dinner is about 9 o'clock at night.
You know? Yeah, I was going to say, so about how long does that all take? It seems like, I mean, that's a whole other extra ordeal that you were not accustomed to prior to.
Yeah,
sure.
That alone is probably a good 20 minutes, just changing that now that I've kind of gotten into that ordeal. Shower, dry off, and I pretty much put on pajamas, so I'm not going to go anywhere. And then go eat, like, leftovers, or sometimes he'll have steaks that he was going to make, and so he has it timed for when I get home, because he has extra gold stars this year. He's always had extra gold stars, but don't tell him, it gets into his ego, you know. But
we won't let him listen to the podcast.
Edit that, please. No.
Well, that's so much, so much change. How are you going into the, I mean, all of that's very physical, and obviously your experiences with the souls that you encounter, because that's truly what it is. They're human, they're people, and they're not numbers. How about the conversation about emotional well-being, and what are you seeing? And then Christy, definitely you can pop in. And when you talk to other nurses, and you guys are obviously have some time to commiserate and talk about what's going on, what do you think the emotional climate is?
That is a good question, because that's it's something, it varies throughout people. Most of the time, everyone is feeling really close to what I feel. We are, I think as a group, we're all, everything that I kind of hear everyone talking about is that we're all realizing that this is here, and it's uncertain, and it's something that we all kind of came to terms with the fact that we were probably going to be positive. The dose that you get of being exposed is, it's kind of like a poison. You know, if you get a low dose, you're going to get sick. If you get a high dose, you're going to get really sick. And so, like, we wear an N95 in the COVID rooms, and that literally means 95% of the particles are being filtered through that mask. And I've been safe for 4 months. You know, I mean, that's what we've been using. But then you have people that are on, like, a high-flow cannula, and then they get that buildup of carbon dioxide, and then they might have to go to a BiPAP, which some people are familiar with the BiPAP and the CPAP that you sleep with. But that aerosols all of the particles that you have in your lungs. And so that room is, like, 30 times more toxic. So we have everything on negative pressure. You know, that's the normal thing. But you're walking in as a nurse, and you have doctors that won't go in that room. You have, they don't just have your patient, they have other patients. And if they go into that room plus another one, we're out of position. I mean, that's a big thing. And it was similar to the priest issue. Like, we have a handful of priests. We can't expose them and risk losing a priest.
Exactly.
And I don't want to say, no one looks at nurses as being expendable. I mean, don't get me wrong, but it's kind of like, guys, we need you to go in and do the assessment so we can watch you through the window and verify all these things. And so there's this point where you realize, you know, no, they're doing everything they can to keep us safe. And I know I'm doing everything I can to keep me safe. But there's a level that you realize, I am going to get this. And not only that, but then there's that responsibility of realizing, can I hug my child? You know, can I kiss my husband goodnight? That was when I came home that first night, and I did all those, you know, all those things, and stripping down, I went outside into the backyard, and I'm just sitting in the back porch looking at my stupid 5 foot chicken that I have, you know, and thinking, this is just kind of a surreal moment. You know, I'm about to be completely alone. I've had my first COVID patients. I'm going to go live in a camper in my front yard. This is what I'm thinking is my new life. And I sat out there for an hour and a half, just kind of processing. And my husband knocked on the back window and just waved at me, and I kind of shook my head no, you know, and he just waved at me, and he walked out into the backyard, and he said, we're risking it. I'm sorry. I can't let you go through this alone, you know, and this is a choice that he made personally, and
you know, then I have to think, but what about kids? You know, what about this? And he's just like, we're going to risk it. It's okay. You know, you're going through this. We're going to go through this. We're a family. But, you know, then I feel like I have to warn everybody that we go around, you know, I'm a COVID nurse. You know, I'm a COVID nurse. Like, I should be wearing a big red C on my shirt. You know, there has to be a trade. You know, like, we can't, like, I don't want to shut the economy down again. I don't want to, you know, not see loved ones. I had nursing home patients that fortunately did get to leave, some of them, and all they talked about was family. Talked about how wonderful it was to see them, you know, on FaceTime and things like that. Things like that that really make a difference that we take for granted. I had a little patient that I had on the COVID unit a while back, and I walked in, he was going to be discharged, and I had told him, and so he got dressed and everything, and then he was sitting, and he'd been there for like 3 weeks. I mean, he's been there for a long time. And he was sitting perched on the back of the couch in there, and with his face pressed against the window, and I walked in, and I said, you look like a little cat, what are you doing? You know, and I was kind of laughed, and he laughed, and he said, I just wanted to feel the sun on my face. I can't wait to get home and feel the sun on my face. And you think about those little things that we take for granted, and we have to look for those joys, and we can't let the virus win that. We just have to, we have to take precautions and make everything an educated risk and weigh it and keep reminding us, you know, ourselves of that.
Well, and I love what you're doing to keep yourself positive, because, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, we tell people as therapists all the time, you've got to make sure you're being able to, you know, kind of refill yourself up with, you know, with time with family or with your, you know, your people of faith or whatever. And right now that's actually being denied to you. So having to reach way, 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 way down in your gut to pull it out and do that. And I'm thinking, I don't know how strong I am. I hope I would be able to do what you're doing. So, I have great respect for that, for you.
Yeah, it's one of those things where you don't realize the limitations that you had. You're finding new bottoms, and you're also finding new highs. So it's kind of weird. My faith has been really strong. It's weird because I'm Catholic, and I have not gone to Mass since all this started, so since spring break. Because I... You know, again, you know, I feel like I'm probably going to be okay, you know, if I go, but I'm not positive right now, but I don't know. I could be a loaded weapon. You know, I don't know. So I can't pass that on to my community. I can't be in a small closed in room with people that may or may not care if that I've done it, not knowing the risk of it, you know, not being fully aware of it. And so, but my faith, I have a St. Jude chaplet I've been praying that has been helping me quite a bit. St. Jude is the patron saint of hopelessness, and which is why they named that hospital, you know, that because it's one of those things where there's nothing left. You know, please help with nothing that we can't control this. So I think relying on a higher power is always a good outlet. I have the fortune of having some priests that I directly text that I've gained friendships with throughout the years, and I can ask professional questions as well as, what is the ethics about this? And I can ask those questions and feel like I have a good response. And honestly, there's a lot of the fellow nurses. We work as a team, and like when I had my really down day, the woman, Maria, that I was working with, she carried me through it. She just kept telling me that I was doing everything right. I'm doing it well. When we have a bad day, everybody kind of steps in and helps and says, what can I do to help? You know, where can I pass the meds for you? Can I do this? And the patients themselves have been amazing. They understand generally, you know, they know those moments that they have a really hard time. And then you might not come in for over an hour. You know, you're trying to check in on them, and you'll just say, I'm sorry, I was in another room. And they'll be like, I totally understand. You're in here when I need you, you know. And that alone has helped amazingly, you know. I mean, just people being real and understanding I mean, I think that that's the light, and that's where I know that we're going to win.
Well, and, you know, Melanie is wanting me to kind of address, you know, the mental health connection and coping mechanisms and everything. And I think, you know, Heather, you just laid it out beautifully. It's like, you know, knowing what you need to do, trusting that you're doing what you need to do, reaching out for help whenever you need it. You know, find the time to just sit and relax and, you know, being able to reach out to people that you trust. And I'm sure that, you know, as a nurse, you do all the things as often as you can, you know, like taking care of your own physical health, you know, getting enough sleep, staying hydrated, getting some rest. Getting some exercise, eating a healthy diet, and just hearing how you're staying connected with people. I'm like, I think you get an A in how to handle everything that you're doing right now.
Thank you.
Just trusting your training, trusting in God, trusting, or in believing that we're going to get through this and that there will be an end to it at some level for all of us. Mm-hmm. So, good
yeah,
job.
I think, yeah, definitely. It's really, there's so many things. I think you've given us so many things to think about. Because it's just an example that even when you're a professional, whatever, in whatever capacity, we don't know what to do. You do your best, mm-hmm. and that's as much as you can do. It's not realistic to isolate yourself from all people all the time. And so we are all kind of in that challenge. And so it makes me kind of understand why people are just, you know, sort of done with it, especially if they're removed from this kind of realness of it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important that we really stop and take a look at what our healthcare workers and our first responders and people on those front lines are experiencing, because this has to weigh on people on so many levels, mental health wise. And that's why, you know, we think it's such an important conversation. As I know we've mentioned, Centers is now providing counseling to all healthcare workers and first responders battling COVID-19. And we have some, really awesome foundations, Garber Foundation and Yarborough Foundation, that are helping, like partnering with us on that. We want to help those that are helping us, because without all of you, we will be relying on all of you to guide us through this, to get us through it, to take care of us. And it's important that we come together as a community to understand that, that the power of how difficult this is, just on our emotional well-being.
Yes.
I'd say that since all this started, I've probably had this discussion with people, that difficult discussion with people, I'd say 3 or 4 times more than I've had in the past years of working. Like, I mean, it's just, you'll have an average month, but maybe you'll never have that discussion with a patient. You know, you'll say it, but if you have to make this decision right now, it's more like something you might want to think and discuss with your family. Okay, do you want this or not? You know what I mean? I mean, it's not mm-hmm. quite that urgent. We try not to put it that way, but it's a hard decision to make.
Absolutely. That is, if anybody out there has ever experienced that, I know what that conversation is like. It's tough. But to be on your side, on the side of the nurses and the doctors and the healthcare workers and people that are, and nurses in particular, it's just got to be so overwhelming and heavy on you. I wonder sometimes how you guys feel about the term hero, because I think you're a hero. I think you're amazing. But I know there's a little bit of that puts so much pressure on you guys, and what you need is the support for your community to support what you're doing and really appreciate it, because no matter what, any of us could happen in the hospital at some point. May not be from this. We want our healthcare system to be strong. I think, isn't that an important message, Heather?
Yeah, we do. We definitely need support from the community. And it's getting old. I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and beg that everybody looks at us as heroes. I joke around with my family because there was one day that everybody happened to be up early. Usually people are asleep when I leave. But they were all up. They were going to do something. I can't remember what he had planned with them. But I came out, and I was in my scrubs, and when I'm going in on COVID, I'll have, you know, some sort of a head wrap or something going. And I walked in, and I was like, hey, guys, I'm going frontline, hashtag frontline. And they're like, bye, Mom. And then I'd walk into the next room, and I'd say, hashtag healthcare hero, hashtag, you know, just joking around with the kids, and they're all like, bye, Mom. You know, it's early. They don't care. They're just like, yeah, okay, whatever. And that's kind of how we feel, you know. And then, so it kind of, I mean, we're happy that people would look to us that way. It's kind of awkward because it's something that, it's like talking about moms, you know. You do that like one time a year where you're on Mother's Day saying, wow, Mom, you really did a lot today. We really appreciate you, you know. Or, okay. We're the housewives of the medical industry, you know. It's humbling, but we feel like it's an important job, and we don't take it lightly. And until now, it hadn't really been something. I've always thought, well, police are putting themselves out there in front of guns, and the firemen are going up buildings, and now I am kind of seeing it as I'm going into a room that a guy has a leaky BiPAP, and that's aerosolizing the virus. And so I'm going into a room that my N95 is only 95% working.
Right.
And I'm about to be, you know, exposed a little bit. And more you get, the worse the exposure. But so far I haven't had a viral load that's enough to make me sick. So it's, you know, you do realize, I am kind of, I'm not throwing myself on a bullet, but I am definitely stepping into an area that I'm not afraid of it. I mean, I think that's something that needs to be known. We can't be afraid of something and hide from it. We have to learn as best we can about it.
I think so. Right. And I think part of the message is important to get across, that it's not fear. Being prepared is not being fearful. It's
right.
Not the same. And you all are not afraid, but you know the risks. You know how we can help stop the spread and make a difference to make it a little easier for all of you and for the rest of us. It's precautions, and precautions are not fear. This has been a really strange time and understatement of the century, but we are collectively trying to figure out how to cope. And I think definitely hearing from people that are actually there, not watching it on TV, not looking at other areas of the world or our country, but here in the Permian Basin, I think it's critical. I mean, I appreciate you letting us talk to you about like what a day's like.
Well, I am really appreciative of how Centers has been working with the community. I think y'all have always done a great job. On a personal note, you know, my first three children were adopted through foster care. And then I had a baby that same year, because 40 kids in a row, you know, in a year is hilarious to God. I think that's fun. And so that's, you know, we've used Centers in the past with some counseling with our children. And just knowing how wonderful of a resource you guys are, and now that we're seeing it for the healthcare community that is fighting this, it's very touching, and we really appreciate it a lot, because we all kind of realize that we're going to be a little messed up. You know, we're kind of watching ourselves. We have little jokes about when this first started, thinking, you know, I thought I was fine. I'm sitting here thinking it's fine, and then all of a sudden I'm out of gin, or all of a sudden I drank a six pack, and you're thinking, whoa, this is affecting me. And so a lot of us have stopped drinking. You know, a lot of us are like, okay, let's watch ourselves a little extra. And when we see somebody stressed out, how are you? You know, and because we know what to watch for. And so I feel like having a resource and knowing that there's not going to be a stigma, you know, and just making sure that we're maintaining ourselves and getting our outlets that we need, I think that's a wonderful resource. And we really appreciate it.
Well, one thing we talk about a lot right now is I think 2020 has basically canceled the stigma of mental health. I mean, it is gone. We've never been more truly aware of it. And it's something, you know, there's always this conversation about, you know, mental health awareness and making sure people understand this is part of our overall health, or, you know, it's part of physical health, mental health. But now I think we are all in this world where it's constant discomfort. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, we have to look for a little laughter and look for a little joy, but the reality is it's just, there isn't, it's not like an event that you know is going to be over. We don't know what's going to happen. It's the uncertain. And so at some point we have to try to take care of each other. And hopefully, I mean, you all are taking care of us, and we're grateful for that. We want to be able to give back and do the same. And so many members of our community are of the same mindset. Hopefully that will continue to grow, and we'll find a way to come together as human beings and avoid some of the social media, because I really don't think that's truly reflective of what's inside of us. I know I can talk to people that are, you know, I'm annoyed with their posts, and then I have a conversation with them and it reminds me, don't just stop looking at that. You've got to have these human connections. There's nothing better than that.
No, there's not. And we need it.
We definitely need it, desperately. So, gosh, Heather, I can't thank you enough for joining us. This is
thank you.
Great. I mean, I feel like the whole time on the I've been on the verge of tears, trying not to cry.
Thank you for everything.
Really meant a lot, and I think has given us a lot to think about.
I really appreciate it. I hope you all stay well and stay safe. Thank you.
Center Solutions is a production of the Recording Library of West Texas. Post-production work is done by Bailey Hennis. Content is provided by Melanie Size and Christy Edwards. Contact Centers for Children and Families at 432-570-1084 or the Recording Library, 432-682-2731. Email Melanie with questions you want answered on the show at msize@centerstexas.org. That's msize@centerstx.org. Both nonprofits are on all social media platforms. See you next time.
To bring us up to time for our next regularly scheduled program, we now bring you the following informative feature.
This program is made available to the IAAIS program share and was recorded at the audio reading service of the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana, for people with print impairments.
Welcome. This is Diabetic News, and I'm your reader, Hadley, with the audio reading service at the Ellen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today I'll be reading from Diabetes Self-Management Magazine online, and I'm beginning with an article called Quality of Sleep, a Tool for Diabetes Management. Anyone can take steps to better manage their diabetes knows the importance of blood glucose monitoring, a balanced diet, and physical activity. In contrast, the importance of sleep can be underestimated as we navigate through our increasingly busy and stressful lives. This is a mistake. Sleep, especially good sleep, is crucial for diabetes self-management. What is meant by good quality sleep? Good quality sleep usually involves falling asleep within 30 minutes, waking up no more than once, spending no more than 20 minutes awake after initially falling asleep, spending 85% or more of total time in bed asleep, feeling satisfied with sleep. Poor quality or excess sleep is referred to as suboptimal sleep. Sleep quality is also determined by the stages of sleep, which are non-rapid eye movement, NREM, which comprises stages 1, 2, and 3. Stage 1 and 2 are light sleep. Stage 3, which is deep sleep, involves the production of slow delta waves when restorative processes such as tissue repair occurs. Rapid eye movement, REM sleep, is an active stage of sleep. You can tell when someone is in this stage because their eyes move rapidly. Dreaming occurs during this phase of sleep, which is important for learning, memory, and mood. There are approximately 4 to 6 sleep cycles during a single night's sleep, each cycle lasting for an average of 90 minutes. The duration of sleep, deep sleep, is longer in the first half of the night, reducing toward the end. In contrast, REM sleep progressively increases in duration over the night. This pattern and timing of deep and REM sleep help regulate the natural secretion of melatonin, the sleep-promoting hormone, which is secreted early in the night, with its levels reducing toward morning. In contrast, cortisol, a stress hormone, is secreted in the second half of the night's sleep, when REM sleep increases in frequency and duration. Therefore, good quality sleep is important for the normal progression of the sleep cycle and other critical body processes that occur during sleep. General indicators of poor quality sleep: sleep duration per night less than 6 hours or more than 10 hours for adults ages 26 to 64. Taking more than 45 minutes to fall asleep. Awakening more than 3 times overnight, each awakening more than 5 minutes. Being awake for more than 40 minutes after initially falling asleep. Spending less than 75% of time in bed asleep. Taking more than 3 naps and 100 minutes of naps per day. What is the connection between sleep quality and diabetes? Dr. Mark Hyman, Ph.D., diabetes psychologist and certified diabetes care and education specialist at the Center for Diabetes and Mental Health in California, says, "It is very common for people with diabetes to report poor sleep quality. In my experience, it is not something we talk enough about or assess for in people with diabetes. Interestingly, diabetes and sleep have been shown to influence each other. Diabetes is associated with insufficient sleep, frequent sleepiness during the day, frequent need to use sleeping pills, urge to urinate during the night. Sleep disorders include insomnia, sleep apnea, which involves brief obstruction of breathing during sleep, and restless leg syndrome, where uncomfortable sensations lead to an irresistible urge to move the legs. In turn, poor quality sleep can lead to abnormal glucose metabolism and insulin resistance, which can increase the risk of diabetes development and negatively impact blood sugar management in diabetes. In people with low glucose tolerance, also known as prediabetes, in which blood glucose levels are higher than normal but not high enough to result in a diabetes diagnosis, lower duration of deep sleep has been shown to increase the number of nighttime awakenings, delay the onset of REM sleep, and increase the secretion of melatonin at the time of awakening instead of during the night. Incidentally, in addition to promoting sleep, melatonin is considered to modulate insulin release and glucose metabolism. Therefore, the delayed secretion of melatonin could reduce insulin release and further decrease glucose tolerance in the morning. Since the control of blood glucose levels is already impaired in individuals with diabetes, such a reduction in deep sleep duration could negatively impact self-management efforts. Emotional toll of poor sleep and diabetes. Poor sleep, as well as low blood glucose during the night, has been linked to depression, fatigue, cognitive impairment, and anxiety among people with diabetes. This can impact daytime functioning, which can affect your ability to engage in self-care behaviors, such as monitoring of blood glucose, taking medicines in a timely manner, and meal planning. Poor sleep can also trigger emotional eating behavior, negatively affecting blood glucose control. Sleeping for less than 5 hours could trigger an increase in the levels of ghrelin, an appetite-stimulating hormone, and decrease in leptin levels, an appetite-suppressing hormone. Therefore, the impact of poor sleep on eating isn't just emotional, It has a physical aspect, too, and can increase feelings of hunger and therefore overconsumption of energy-dense foods and sweet foods that increase blood glucose levels. Can oversleeping be a problem, too? Oversleeping, which leads to excessive REM sleep in the morning, could also affect blood sugar levels. In the latter part of the night, the release of cortisol prepares the body for waking up and increases blood glucose levels. When you wake up in the morning after sufficient sleep, your body uses this glucose. However, when you sleep for a longer duration than normal, the excess blood sugar is not utilized, leading to abnormally high blood sugar levels, which can be especially harmful to people with diabetes. What causes poor sleep quality in people living with diabetes? There are several challenges to getting good quality sleep specific to people with diabetes, says Heyman. First is overnight blood sugar control. People who have high and low blood sugars at night tend to have lower quality of sleep. According to Heyman, potential information overload is another challenge to achieving good quality sleep, especially with continuous glucose monitoring, CGM, and the frequency of alarms associated with it. He explains, with blood sugars always available on the phone, there can be a temptation to constantly be monitoring blood sugar, even at night. Excessively thinking about one's blood sugar keeps the mind active and can cause anxiety, making sleep more challenging. Depression and neuropathic pain are another possible cause of poor sleep among people with diabetes. How can you improve sleep while managing diabetes? I would encourage people to work with their healthcare team to find strategies to keep overnight blood sugars in range, says Heyman. I would also encourage people on CGM to adjust their overnight alarm settings to go off less frequently while still keeping them safe. Finally, I would encourage people to use stress management techniques such as mindfulness, progressive muscle relaxation, and limiting screen time before bed to help them manage anxiety and improve their sleep. Sleep quality as well as anxiety regarding glucose levels at night could be improved by using closed-looped glucose control system as opposed to open-loop systems. Closed-loop system automatically calculate and administer basal background insulin, largely eliminating the need for alarms, which could improve sleep quality for both people with diabetes and their caregivers or family. In contrast, open-loop systems alert the user to abnormal glucose levels through alarms and require the user to calculate the dose of insulin for high glucose levels. Sleep disorders such as insomnia and obstructive sleep apnea can be effectively managed by cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, and continuous positive airway pressure, CPAP, respectively. With guidance from your healthcare provider, you could also consider pharmaceutical interventions such as melatonin supplements. Sufficient physical activity and other lifestyle changes such as consuming a healthy diet can also improve sleep without adverse effects on glucose levels. How can diet improve sleep? Currently, there is not much clarity regarding how specific foods or diets can improve sleep in people with diabetes. However, research suggests that sleep quality could be improved by following a diet richer in proteins than carbohydrates or by following a Mediterranean diet, an eating style that tends to be rich in vegetables, fruits, grains, beans, nuts, olive oil, and fish. Both of these diets have been shown to improve the control of blood glucose levels among individuals with type 2 diabetes. In some cases, tryptophan supplementation has been shown to aid sleep. Tryptophan is an amino acid that increases serotonin levels, a precursor to the sleep hormone melatonin. Foods high in tryptophan include chicken, eggs, cheese, fish, peanuts, sesame seeds, and turkey. For individuals with vitamin B deficiency, supplementation of this vitamin could improve sleep quality. Alternatively, eating vitamin B-rich foods such as whole grains, meats, eggs, legumes, seeds, and dark leafy green vegetables may be beneficial. Additionally, deep sleep can be improved by consuming sufficient food to meet your calorie requirements without exceeding these requirements. Sleep for self-care. considering this association between sleep and diabetes, American Diabetes Association has recommended that sleep pattern and duration be assessed as part of diabetes management. So in creating your self-management plan, make sure you address your sleep patterns. You and your diabetes could benefit from some well-deserving shut-eye. Not too much, though. Tips to take care of diabetic feet. Infections, circulation problems, and nerve damage are common problems among people with diabetes, meaning it's especially important to prioritize caring for your feet if you are living with this condition. Maintaining a healthy lifestyle and managing your diabetes can help you take care of your feet. In this guide, we're going to offer a detailed overview of how to take care of your feet to prevent any complications. What are the effects of diabetes on feet? Two serious conditions of the feet that can develop in people with diabetes are peripheral vascular disease, diabetic neuropathy. Here is a brief overview of these conditions. Diabetic neuropathy. If you fail to regulate the levels of your blood sugar, uncontrolled diabetes can cause nerve damage. If you have damaged nerves in your feet and legs, you may not be able to feel cold or heat in those areas, or you may experience pain or numbness. This lack of feeling or diabetic peripheral neuropathy can be serious because you may not feel if you've cut or injured your feet or legs. Peripheral vascular disease. We all know that diabetes can affect the flow of blood, which makes it take longer for an injury or a sore to heal. Peripheral vascular disease affects blood flow in the legs and arms. Any injury or infection that does not heal because of poor blood flow can increase your chances of developing gangrene or ulcers. Other foot problems in people with diabetes. In addition to diabetic neuropathy and peripheral vascular disease, there are a number of other foot problems that people with diabetes may experience. Overlooking any of these complications may lead to serious consequences, including amputation. Let's find out more about foot complications that can result due to diabetes. Fungal infections. Such infections are common among people who have trouble maintaining optimal blood sugar levels. Nails are often vulnerable to fungal infections, which could lead to discoloring or thickening. Wearing the wrong type of shoes can also create a moist, dark, and warm environment for a fungal infection to thrive. Since fungal nail infections can be challenging to treat, people with diabetes should try to prevent them by taking good care of their nails. In some cases, their doctor may recommend removing the damaged nail to protect other parts of the feet. Athlete's foot. A type of fungus that causes redness, itching, and cracking of the feet is called athlete's foot. In this condition, germs enter through skin's cracks and lead to an infection. To treat this condition, your doctor will likely prescribe medication to kill the fungus. This medication can be in the form of creams or pills. Calluses. Calluses are buildups of hard skin, which are typically on the underside of the feet. One reason calluses form on the feet is because of an uneven distribution of weight. A skin condition or ill-fitting shoes can also lead to their formation. Don't try to remove calluses at home, and let a doctor examine them to determine the best treatment. You can use a pumice stone for removing the built-up tissue gently, but don't remove or cut it using a sharp object. Corns. A buildup of hard skin near a toe, between your toes, or a bony area is a corn. In many cases, corns arise due to friction between your toes or pressure from shoes that rub against your toes. Taking care of corns is important, but never remove or cut the corn using a sharp object. The best way to take care of corns is to gently remove them using a pumice stone after you take a shower or bath. Blisters. Blisters result whenever your shoes rub the same spot on your foot over and over. Blisters are common among people who don't wear comfortable shoes or who wear shoes without socks. Don't pop your blisters in an attempt to cure them, but instead use an antibacterial cream and bandages for preventing infection and protecting the skin. Bunions. Whenever your big toe bends toward your second toe, you risk developing bunions, Generally, in people with this condition, the spot where the big toe joins the foot becomes calloused and red, and it may become hard and stick out. In many cases, bunions form on both feet. Although wearing high heels is the most common reason behind their formation, bunions may also run in the family. Avoid wearing heels or shoes that put pressure on your big toe and push it toward your second toe. Wear shoes with foam or felt padding to prevent any irritation to the bunion. People with diabetes should opt for flats or shoes that do not put any pressure on the big toe. In some cases, the doctor may use a device for separating the big and second toes. In rare cases, the doctor may recommend surgery for realigning the toes if the bunion causes deformity or severe pain. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Hadley with Diabetic News. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, the Center Solutions Podcast, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
This is a Recording Library of West Texas Community Update.
Grocery store hours during coronavirus. United Supermarket, 6 a.m. to 11 p.m. For shoppers 60 plus, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday. For shoppers 60 plus, 7 to 9 a.m. Tuesday and Thursday. H-E-B, 7 a.m. to 10 p.m. Customers 60 plus. Orders can be called in 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at 833-397-0080. Groceries will be delivered by Favor Delivery. For more information, go to newsroom.heb.com. Market Street, 6 a.m. to midnight. For shoppers 60 plus, 7 to 9 a.m. Monday and Thursday. Walmart, 7 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. 7 to 8 a.m. curbside delivery pickup for first responders and customers 60 plus with disabilities or at risk.
Of all the interesting places in our country, the American West may just have the most interesting stories.
Following New Mexico's road to statehood from Las Cruces to Santa Fe and the enchanted stops in between.
Recording Library of West Texas volunteer Jack reads articles from Range, American Cowboy, and other publications on the Western Magazine Hour.
Hi, this is Jack with articles from the magazine Sunset, Living in the West.
Book reviews, biographies, travel tips, fiction, topical articles, historical pieces, and more.
Here's an insider's guide to the season's best getaways in the West.
The Western Magazine Hour.
Where did it come from? Western music.
Wednesday mornings at 11 and again Sunday afternoons at 5.
Horseback on the V-Bar Ranch, Wyoming.
On Recording Library of West Texas Radio. Read by listening.
Now here's your forecast for the Midland-Odessa area. It's 46 and mostly cloudy. Mostly cloudy tonight with a low in the low 40s. Then tomorrow a few showers with a high in the upper 40s. Tomorrow night, mostly cloudy with a low in the mid-40s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
This is the Recording Library of West Texas. It's 11 a.m.
This program is intended for a print-impaired audience and is brought to you by Mind's Eye.
Good evening, and welcome to Vanity Fair Magazine. I'm your host, Paul Droba. Thanks for joining us tonight. So here we go again, one more year, 2021. Hard to believe. And as Freddie Mercury and Queen would say, another one bites the dust. What better way to start the year than talking politics? In the wake of a presidential election, this time of the year is pretty quiet, with the exception of the inauguration. Well, not this year. This year could be that as President Biden, and yes, he is the incoming president, gives his inaugural address, they might be dragging Trump's furniture out of the White House and throwing it onto the front lawn. That would be a really bad look. Our first story tonight is a profile of a congresswoman that President Trump and his supporters love, just love, to hate. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, better known as AOC. Will she single-handedly destroy America? We'll find out tonight. Our second story this evening deals with the outgoing president, and yes, he is on his way out. Our author is still angry about the Hollywood Access tapes, but the good news is, hopefully, that that type of behavior is finally coming to an end, at least in Hollywood. Let's begin. Our story is titled Becoming AOC, and the blurb that precedes it reads, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on how she got here and where she's headed. Let's read. Her Republican colleagues had, up until then, been civil. But one day in late July, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez stood on the steps of the U.S. Capitol while Representative Ted Yoho lost his shit. The Florida Republican, incensed by the New York Congresswoman's recent comments linking crime and poverty, jabbed his finger in her face, calling her crazy and disgusting. She froze. The situation felt dangerous, with Yoho towering over Ocasio-Cortez, who calls herself 5'5 on a good day. Congressman Roger Williams, a Texas Republican, bumbled next to him like a wind puppet at a used car dealership. She told Yoho he was being rude and went into the Capitol to vote. As Yoho descended the steps, he called her a fucking bitch. A reporter nearby witnessed the exchange, and soon the whole world had heard the epithet. This part has not